Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. It's really true. You are what you eat and drink. On this week's episode, we're talking with the experts about what we consume and the effects it has on the human mind, body, and spirit. Award-winning journalist Corby Kummer weighs in on the topic of weight loss, from fad diets to scientific studies on eating, cause and effect. Then, the doctor's in the house, Dr. Mignon Mary, whose approach to good health involves a careful balance of vitamins, minerals, and surprisingly, hormones. And then there's our old friend bread. Weight Watchers are always conscious of their consumption of the staff of life. Wait till you hear what Washington State University PhD candidate Bridget Mintz has to share about her research in the university's bread lab. We're blinding you with science on this week's Louisiana Eats. Believe that fat, a word with a decidedly bad rap in the world of diet and nutrition, could actually be part of the answer to weight control? Now, before you start scarfing down the cheeseburgers and ice cream, let's check in with our resident health and food policy expert, senior editor for The Atlantic, Corby Kummer. Corby's recent investigative reporting reveals that eating healthy fat while eliminating sugar and simple carbs could be a long-term solution to the never-ending issue of weight loss. We spoke with Corby, who gave us the word on Dr. David Ludwig's latest diet research.
So Dr. David Ludwig at Boston's Children's Hospital has for years been trying to help diabetic young people and diabetic patients all across the board to understand how to control their weight. And he's also a pediatrician, but a researching chemist and doctor who has been trying to understand how people eat and gain weight and lose weight and what the relation between what you actually put into your mouth and what your body weight is, because it's not always so obvious and it's not always as direct as you would think. And for years he'd been doing studies with especially diabetic adolescents, because trying to help young people who are diabetic and very overweight lose weight is going to improve their health throughout their lives. But how do you do it? And how do you help them understand how they cannot be hungry and reset their metabolism? And the way that he found was so unintuitive. It was kind of what we all want to think, which is you can have as much as fat as you want. There's a catch, though. And the big catch is you can't have sugar, you can't have bread, you can't have white rice. There's lots of simple carbohydrates as opposed to complex carbohydrates that take longer to digest that you pretty much have to cut out. But if you do, he says, and you have lots of nuts and full-fat yogurt and things that will curb your hunger, you will wind up eating much less.
Isn't that fascinating? So the name of his book, Always Hungry, made its debut in the third spot of the New York Times bestseller list this past January. And I guess it is sort of a fascinating phenomena how every January there's new diet books and they all do really well for just a little while.
And there's a reason. Any diet will work for just a little while. So if you put yourself on a diet, in fact, both you and I could write a best-selling diet book and pretty much make up any diet plan we like. It's very easy to lose weight if you keep eating the same thing you know, the grapefruit diet, the South Beach diet, Atkins, of course, which is kind of a version of these low-carbohydrate, high-protein diets. And all these diets work for a while, and you lose weight. The question is, how long before you start eating what you used to and you just become too hungry to stick to the diet? And what David Ludwig and another woman I also have been interviewing named Susan Roberts at Tufts School of Nutrition in Boston, who has something called the I diet, which is similar but has important differences to Ludwig's. What they're promising is long-term change in your eating habits, because you will be satisfied. If you are satisfied, you don't have to constantly look to crave, to satisfy your short-term cravings with pralines in New Orleans, which, of course, I do at every other storefront when I am walking through the quarter.
Of course. Explain the role that hormones brings into this, because you completely sort of translate it for the layman very clearly in your writing.
Well, what David Ludwig, the science writer and journalist Gary Taubes, who's written best-selling books about fat and sugar and has another book, I think it's just called Against Sugar, that's going to be, I think, the last word on the topic coming out this fall. What they have been saying is that eating sugar and refined carbohydrates and white bread and plain sugar wreaks much more damage than the simple calories would suggest. So white rice and white bread, they change the hormonal balance and they create an imbalance that overproduces insulin, which is what makes your fat cells hoard calories. And once those calories are hoarded and they are locked up in your body, you're both fat and hungry. So the insulin is saying, we need to hoard those calories for the future for some kind of possible future hunger, which is a primitive mechanism in our bodies. So they won't release it to be used for energy and to burn off fat. And because they're imprisoned, which the overproduction of insulin by your eating these sugary foods keeps them imprisoned, keeps the insulin going and saying, you know, we're putting your fat calories in a lockbox. But that means that you're in a deprived, hungry situation. So even people who have lots of fat cells, they still need to eat because they feel hungry. So what they want to do is reverse that or put a brake on it by preventing the production of insulin in your body by you're not eating sugar. And the foods that cause the overproduction of insulin and the hoarding of fat cells.
I was fascinated that Dr. Ludwig says that obesity is really a state of starvation.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that sure explains a lot in America, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And, you know, we haven't talked about soda, but sugary drinks are considered the very worst actor in this, mostly because, or largely because, You're dumping all the sugar into your system. You're creating the production of all this insulin. You're hoarding fat cells, but much worse, without any kind of fiber or anything in your body that will suggest, hey, stop eating. You've had enough. You're sated. You're not hungry anymore. You never compensate. Usually, even if you have like a piece of pie or something that's quite sugary, there will be other stimulants to your gastrointestinal system that will register in your brain, okay, you've eaten, there's a massive food in your body, we can hang on for a while without eating. But when it's sugary drinks, evidently there is not satiety. It doesn't register in your brain. It bypasses the satiety registration mechanism. And so all you do is keep having more food because you continue to be hungry. Yeah, one of the revelations I had is you will have no trouble getting any diet authority on any side of the spectrum to say it's a waste of time to count calories, it won't help you. What they say is it's the overall balance and the kind of food you're eating, not the number of calories, that you will be able to control. And it's changing meal patterns and habits that's the most important to controlling your weight.
Explain that. What do you mean by meal patterns?
Oh, so it's trying to eat at the same time every day, have snacks at about the same time, make sure that the snacks are things like fresh fruit, they don't have refined carbohydrates in them, or a handful of nuts, or a cup of yogurt, or fiber one cereal, or whatever it is that you're allowing yourself to eat, and not kind of following your nose to the vending machine and having cookies. They also think in David Ludwig's book, and I think that he's always hungry, and Susan Roberts in her I Diet, I think they would also say that once you get into this kind of healthy eating routine, and you do it for months at a time, you learn much more about when you're hungry and when you're not. And you know when to stop. And learning when to stop and training your body to tell you when it's not hungry anymore is really one of the hardest things to do on any diet.
Well, that delicious high-fat yogurt, yum, it actually plays another part in a third thing that needs to be considered. Let's talk a little bit about microbiomes and probiotics.
So, microbiomes are thought now to completely rule our lives and our systems. So everything now is about the microbiome and the colonies of tens and tens of thousands of bacteria that line our gastrointestinal tract and are thought now to send signals to the brain about how much you want to eat and not. And so the more of these you have that kind of eat up cells that could produce insulin and make you hungry, the better off you will be. And so yogurt is really good. These are theorized as being great weight control mechanisms. So the more yogurt you have with live bacteria in them, there are certain foods that come across in dietary studies, especially nuts and yogurt, that have no net increase on your weight, no matter how much you eat them. So they're associated with either weight stability or weight loss. And I don't know that anybody particularly knows why, but the current theory is that in yogurt, it's probiotics, which help you maintain weight the way they help rats maintain weight in studies.
Well, no wonder it's so confusing for the American public, because they're always changing the rules on us. They're always changing, you know, the food chart and the pyramid, and nobody seems to be able to make up their mind. So how are you choosing to live now?
I've stopped eating nearly as much sugar as I did before. I can't cut it out. I like it too much. I've never had soda ever. So that's not a problem for me. But I do have chocolate syrup in drinks, and I'm trying to cut that down, too. And luckily, Starbucks has started finally offering sugar-free chocolate syrup, which is one of my dietary staples now. And it has lots of artificial ingredients that are really bad. But sugar is something that you associate with a lift and increased energy. Anyone who studies what it actually does to your system will tell you you're going to have a dietary you're going to have an energy drop off, so it's very bad for you. But I've become much less afraid of high fat yogurt or fat in meat, because the overarching message of David Ludwig's Always Hungry, which has remained on the bestseller list for much longer than a lot of the New Year's resolution books do. Here we are talking at the beginning of spring, and it's still on the Times Diet and How-To and Self-Improvement bestseller list. One of the things it says is just stop being so afraid of fat. It will make you less hungry. You will stop eating naturally if you will not be afraid of fat. And I have to say that even when the dietary guidelines started saying no more fat, no more high fat, and you can have just as much non-fat food as you like, the Snackwells phenomenon, even then, the Mediterranean diet researchers I most admired were saying, part of the Mediterranean diet that everybody loves was 40% fat. It was olive oil, it was a good kind of fat, but it was good. So don't fear fat. That's probably the main message of the new crop of books.
Corby Cummer, food scientist at the New Republic and senior editor at The Atlantic. When we come back from a short break, the doctor's in the house. Dr. Minya Mary, who shares some important news about the effects hormones have on your weight. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. If you live in or have visited New Orleans, especially around carnival season, you may have spotted a mobile hydration clinic driving around. This doctor's office on wheels is an extension of the Remedy Room, a clinic specializing in infusion therapy to aid in rehydration and detoxification. But his founder, Dr. Minya Mary, explains there's more to what they do than just help people recover after a long night out.
I think we need to change the tagline too. It's not just about hangovers, but certainly we treat people for dehydration for whatever the cause. Whether you're coming back from a trip from Mexico, we had some racers this week, and then we have people who have chronic disease, who have chronic GI conditions like Crohn's, or maybe they've had bariatric surgery. So for whatever reason, they would be malnourished or needing a nutrient boost.
It's amazing what incredibly terrible things vitamin deficiencies can do to your body.
I think we live in a world that's keeping us from being well because we're toxic, right? So after 40, we're starting to see more. I see a lot more women than men, but men are having the problem too, where we live in this environment that's toxic. The food we're eating isn't the best. Even if we eat from great sources, the minerals are not in the soil. And so we're deficient in a lot of vitamins. And even if we draw the blood levels, we may not be off the radar or low enough to be considered deficient on an insurance paper. But if you replenish that vitamin, the patient gets better or the patient can heal. And so it's all about balance. When we talk about healing, it's either going to be dehydration, a nutritional deficiency, or hormonal imbalance, or a toxicity issue. And once we clear those up, then I feel the body can do its thing and the immune system can kind of pick up the pieces and heal.
It really all has to do with what we're putting into and onto our bodies. You and I were talking not too long ago, and you spit out some crazy statistic about women and how many different chemicals we've applied someplace or another before we walk out the door in the morning.
Yeah, by the time we're done putting on hairspray and our makeup and our skin cream and our sunscreen and our perfume and the body soap that we got from a store that smells delicious, we have over 250 chemicals on our body. And the skin is our biggest organ, so we're absorbing that, and then we're having to deal with that toxic load. So again, I always talk about 40, after 40, but it's because as we age, we're not able to deal with the toxic buildup. That's when we start to feel the effects. When we're young, we have a lot of growth hormone. We're super healers. We are, you know, kind of curing ourselves overnight. But as we age, because the toxic burden gets so high and we don't have as many antioxidants, we don't produce as many, and probably because our diet now has accumulated and gotten worse as well, we're not able to get past that toxic burden. So then we start to feel sick. We're either tired or some of those other hormonal complaints where we don't have good skin turgor or our hair is falling out. Or the biggest complaint I can tell you I see is that people are just, in general, they're exhausted. And it's multifold, but it does come down to what we're eating. So you're probably not going to escape this year without hearing about the microbiome or about the GI tract or the gut. But 80 to 90% of the serotonin, which is our happy hormone, is made in the gut. So what we eat matters the most. And not only what we eat, but the foods we eat need to be the least inflaming foods. So we live in the most amazing food city in the world. But if we can avoid the foods that cause inflammation and raise our insulin levels, then we can reduce the damage that it does to not only the body, but to the brain. And we can keep the good gut flora, the good microbiome growing.
One of the things I really wanted to talk about today are the effect of hormones in your weight situation. Would you demystify that for us?
Yeah, so hormones actually, I think, play the most important role when it comes to weight loss. And if the hormones aren't in balance, then you're not going to have as great a success. And it doesn't matter what diet you choose or what food you're eating, because if you have an excessive amount of the most inflaming hormone, which is insulin, that comes out when you eat quite a bit of sugar or too many carbs or too much protein, insulin is there to help grab any excess sugar and store it for later. So when insulin is out, you're going to store fat. And so insulin is the most atherogenic or plaque-forming and harming hormone, but we need it, right? We can't live without it. But we don't need to have it coming out as often, and the way to do that is to focus more on the vegetables and the good healthy fats like olive oil, avocado, coconut oil, even ghee. And then if you are going to eat meat or fish, then hopefully it's from sources that are going to be the least inflaming, so grass-fed and organic and those things that have the least toxicity. So if you can't get to that phase yet and that's not, you know, you're not able to shop at Whole Foods or at your local market, then start with just reducing the breads and reducing the pastas where you can. So wherever you can reduce the inflaming foods and maybe budget them for another time, you know, I think it's all about budgets. And now that we live in this really tight economy, people know about budgeting. I tell them to do the same thing with their sugars. And so if we can get away from the sugar, the more you get away from it, the less you will want it. But you need to go up on the good fat to sustain you so that you're not hungry for it. And that's where the big difference is in the newer studies showing that fat can keep you full. And I think we're kind of going back in time like we always do. You know, everything repeats itself. We're going back to the way our great-great-grandparents used to eat, where we use the lard, we use the good fats, and we aren't so afraid of it anymore.
So for people who are trying to lose weight, is there something in this panoply of hormones and various things that one needs to be aware of and concerned about besides insulin?
The next would be vitamin D. So I think that it should be considered a pro-hormone instead of a vitamin. Now, we do have to be careful of it because it's fat-soluble, so you can overdose. But there seems to be a scourge these days where almost everyone I check is low. And if you are, you know, under 30, you're going to need to load that vitamin. If I had two tests to check on everyone, if I had one, I'd pick vitamin D, one lab test. If you only give me one in the world, I'd pick D. And then if I had two, I'd pick fasting insulin and D, because those are two things that I would do something differently in my management. I would certainly replace, and then I would tell people not to be so afraid of the sun. For a good 20 minutes a day, we can go and get some sunshine without being burned. You know, the burning of the skin is sort of the body's red light to say, okay, you've had enough, right? So I'm not a big fan of slathering sunscreen, but I am a fan of getting enough vitamin D and trying to convert on your own through your skin.
Dr. Mignon Mary, founder and primary physician of The Remedy Room.
I'm Bridget Meintz. I'm a PhD student at Washington State University, Mount Vernon Research and Extension Center in northwestern Washington, and I am in the Plant Breeding and Genetics program, and I'm also part of the Bread Lab, and I work primarily on breeding barley for food and malt, and I also work on dry beans.
While the general public may know next to nothing about barley breeding and its impact on our food systems, Bridget Meintz has taken an obsession for this field to an illuminating level. Bridget is a PhD candidate at Washington State University and works in their Bread Lab, a research institution seeking to get back to the old ways of stone milling and baking bread as an antidote to the nutritionally empty bread found on grocery store shelves.
So we are interested in doing things that not many people in the country are doing right now, and that is creating local grain economies. And that was sort of how the Bread Lab started, was to find a way for the farmers to keep those grains in the community. Because if you're a baker and you have flour shipped to your bakery, you need it to perform in a very specific way. And especially the large industrial bread making operations, if you can really call it bread, where they're mixing it into a frenzy and popping it into plastic bags in 2 hours. You know, we have all these definitions of what things are. If you have a fruit cocktail, you know how on the side it'll say 5% juice?
Yeah.
Well, that bread that you're buying in the store, maybe that should say 0% bread, because that's not really bread in the sense that bread used to be bread. So we're sort of going back to that slow fermentation where it takes a day or so to make that loaf, and the taste results are incredible. So we do have a resident baker in our lab. He's not a scientist. He was a musician and then trained in San Francisco as a baker, and he is incredible. We have what we're now referring to as the hundo rule. He has to use 100% whole grain in his bread. And so we have about 10 different mills in our lab, and we try and only use fresh milled grain.
Which really, really makes a huge difference.
Oh, it makes a huge difference. It's much more flavorful, sort of grassy overtones. And he bakes most days a lot of bread, scones. He's sort of just experimenting and figuring out varietal differences between different wheats and grains in the breads that he's making. So we mostly try and stone mill our flour, because most of the flour that you see in the grocery store has been milled through a roller mill, which removes all of the nutritional parts of the wheat and leaves you with just the endosperm, which is just a lot of starch.
So you're eating calories and you're not really getting the nutrition
exactly.
If you're not eating good bread.
And even if you're buying whole wheat flour, it's been separated, and then some of that bran, which is where all the micronutrients and minerals are located, has been added back in.
Well, is there anything that you can think of commercially that people who might want to bake a healthier bread that's available to them?
We do a lot of work with King Arthur Flour, and we really like them. If you can find a local mill, and I know that more and more of those are starting to pop up again, there's a good chance that that's been milled more recently, and it's probably a fresher product.
Bridget Mintz, PhD candidate at Washington State University's Bread Lab and Small Grains Breeding Program. No matter which diet philosophy you subscribe to, everyone should be eating their greens. Kale, collards, chard, all have a reputation for being a bit bitter and usually aren't everyone's cup of tea, unless there's bacon involved. Bacon, that ingredient that we all love, but that decidedly does not love us. Luckily, our other best friend, butter, is back in favor again, dietarily speaking. One of my favorite recipes from my first book, The Crescent City Farmers Market Cookbook, published in 2009, is Swiss chard with anchovy butter. Anchovy haters, you've got to trust me on this one. Easy-to-make anchovy compound butter will add pop to any dish, from sautéed greens to a savory porterhouse steak. Combine anchovy fillets, peppercorns, and sweet unsalted butter in your food processor. Process until smooth, then roll the compound butter into a log, wrap it in plastic wrap, and refrigerate for at least a half an hour before using. In the meanwhile, wash your greens well and trim off the tough center rib. Melt a pat of your anchovy butter in a skillet and add the greens. Sauté those greens, stirring continuously for just a minute or two. Then add some red or white wine vinegar and serve. Easy, delicious, and healthy. What more could you want? I'm Poppy Tooker, and Swiss chard with anchovy compound butter is real Louisiana Eats. For a copy of this recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com. Or if you'd like a personalized copy of the Crescent City Farmers Market Cookbook, just visit poppytooker.com. It could be a perfect gift for Mother's Day. Just saying. Healthfully speaking, why are anchovies our friend? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and by Ralph's on the Park, where you can sip and savor Chef Chip Flanagan's globally influenced New Orleans cuisine, overlooking the lush foliage and towering oaks of City Park. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch and private events at 900 City Park Avenue in New Orleans, Mid-City. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Healthfully speaking, why are anchovies our friend? Anchovies are rich in protein, vitamins, and minerals, all essential for good health. They contain calcium, iron, magnesium, phosphorus, potassium, sodium, and zinc. Anchovies are a good source of vitamins such as thiamine, riboflavin, niacin, folate, vitamin C, B12, B6, A, E, and vitamin K. They're also full of fatty acids and good cholesterol, which means they're super heart healthy. But they also improve skin health and strengthen teeth. Anchovies will reduce your risk of osteoporosis and macular degeneration. So please, get over your fear of those tiny little fish and start sneaking them into your meals by using them as a substitute for table salt. The essential body salt of anchovies is simply magical. And I promise you, used correctly, they won't taste fishy at all. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Pink champagne and stone. Back in February, dietitian Molly Kimball stopped by our studio to tell us about an Eat Fit NOLA challenge to give up alcohol for the 40 days of Lent. Many Louisiana Eats listeners participated in the challenge, including our producer Joe Schreiner. Now that Easter has come and gone, Molly's back to share her results.
Okay, so Poppy, I've been writing for NOLA.com for 8 years now. This had the most shares, the most page views of anything I've ever done. From California to New York, we had people emailing me, hey, I'm doing this, you know, I'm on board. Got an email from someone from Spain, which I thought was really cool. And then Switzerland, because he heard you. He heard our radio show, and he was like, I was listening to Poppy's podcast, and I really want to do this. And so he did really well throughout the entire challenge. And I think it was, you know, speaking for him a little bit, it sounds like it was pretty pivotal, pretty life-impacting for him, to say the least. It was so well received, and it wasn't a requirement for people to email me to sign up for the challenge, but I had almost 100 people who just individually said, hey, I want to let you know I'm doing this so I have this accountability. So what was neat was along the way, I blind copied everyone, and every few days we kind of send out, you know, hey, how's it going? And often when I would have a struggle that maybe somebody shared with me, I would let the group know, hey, here's some feedback I'm getting, because if one person's going through it, probably a lot of other people are as well. And that really got a lot of the flow of the dialogue. It was, I think, kind of almost a little bit therapeutic for a lot of our participants as well.
That's fascinating. Well, of course, one of the ways that we got involved in this project with you is that our very own executive producer, Joe Schreiner, agreed to take the challenge. So Joe, tell Molly, how did it go?
I made it 38 days. 38.
Well, 38 is really impressive.
I thought I could do the whole 40, but I couldn't make it.
Well, you had a little wedding interference.
I had a wedding interference, and I should actually admit to you, it wasn't just the wedding. I work for a show that deals with food and alcohol. The Absinthe show got in the way, and then the St. Patrick's Day show.
Yeah, there you go. Blame it all on me. You know, that's how it always goes. It was my fault that Joe couldn't do
it. I was at Faye's Pub doing a postcard. I could not have a pint. I just had to.
38 days is incredibly impressive, though. You know, and there's a lot of people who, starting out, were wondering, am I going to be able to even do the 2 days or 3 days?
Yeah, the first week and a half, I'd say, was really easy. And then that's when it started getting difficult.
It's interesting because the feedback that I got from people, it was definitely one or the other for people. So some said that the first part was easy, almost like anytime you do something new, it kind of is like fun and it's different and you're kind of staying focused. Then it got harder once the newness wore off. But I would say for probably 80% of the people, it was the opposite. That first week was like they were itchy. It was almost like they were so uncomfortable in their own skin. And during those what we call witching hours, you know, so that transition time when they're used to having that cocktail. But then after that week or 2 weeks, things kind of settled out and it got easier. So it was really interesting to see the differences in how we all react to it. The physical benefits that people would see is sleep. So hands down, better sleep. That was the most noticeable, and it didn't take long for that to happen. Within a few days, people would say, wow, I'm sleeping better. I could always maybe fall asleep if I'd had a few cocktails, but I was waking up throughout the night. So better quality sleep, deeper sleep, waking up feeling more rested across the board was just a given for almost pretty much everybody. That was the feedback. Improved texture of the skin, so not the dryness, not the flakiness and ruddiness. So improved texture, improved appearance of the skin, and especially under eye circles. So less under eye circles, whiter whites of the eyes. That was some of the physical things, and also better clarity. So less brain fog through the day, more focus, more clarity. That was across the board, over and over and over, the feedback we got. And I think that was what really tuning into those things was what made people able to stay on track, even if they were kind of had that temptation.
What were some of your personal stories that were your favorites?
So on NOLA.com, we have a summary of a lot of our top kind of inspirations. We've got those going online that I've had about 40 pages of content from people.
Wow.
So I kind of filtered it through and said, okay, what's the best of the best that we can pull here? But some of them, as I was reading them, tears are coming to my eyes. So some things that I thought were really interesting is I think some people did it just because, wow, this is kind of a Lent challenge, let me do it. Others maybe had a question mark of if they were doing, you know, a little bit too extreme, too excessive, and doing it under the umbrella of health made it less daunting or less intimidating. And there was a lot of people in them coming to terms with, I'm drinking for the wrong reasons. Some people who realized that, okay, I really maybe have been taking this too far, interestingly, the people that are closest to them that you would think would say, "Ah, thank goodness you're finally dialing it back," actually would give them a hard time about it. And you realize that when you cut back on drinking, some of the people around you, if they maybe have, you know, issues as well, it makes them uncomfortable when you dial it back. I had people who said that, you know, their partner would say, "Well, you're boring now." Well, that's not very encouraging to keep going with this, you know. And so that was some of the things, even within interpersonal relationships, that people didn't have the support that they had hoped that they would get from the people around them. You know, I definitely don't want people to think, "Oh my gosh, like this is a finger wagging thing and we shouldn't drink." Not that at all, but it definitely opened my eyes to when someone's struggling with this and when it's a challenge, alcohol is truly everywhere. And it's places that you don't expect it to be. You know, it's at the coffee shop, it's at the health food store checkout line. And I think that can be fun. Oh, we're going to a movie. Oh, let's grab a couple of these. But it can also be a really daunting thing for someone who does have the issues with it and is trying to limit it because the access is everywhere.
Registered dietitian Molly Kimball.
So I'm Claire Smith-Warner and head of spirit creation for Belvedere Vodka.
Eat, drink, live. Sounds familiar, but just a bit different, eh? This philosophy is the foundation of Claire Smith-Warner's Healthy Living Program for cocktail professionals. But her insight into reducing sugar intake is great advice for just about anyone. Claire shared some of her wisdom with us, starting with ways to drink moderately. I think when people think of cocktailing, they don't necessarily think that it's a good thing that they're doing for themselves. So your philosophy, on the other hand, is
to, yeah, drink, eat, live. And to, you know, we have a responsibility to drink responsibly. But I think beyond that, we have a responsibility to sweeten moderately. I think there's been lots of information in the media over the last few years about the dangers of sugar and what it could do to the body. And we have a particular position on that, in that fructose in particular is very challenging for the body to metabolize through the liver. And if you add fructose to alcohol, if you make a cocktail, then you're doubly stressing the liver. So while we talk about responsible drinking, we also talk about responsible sweetening. So we really try to use minimal sugar, and we also try to avoid using fructose where possible. So an easy way of thinking about it is, if you're going to put orange juice in a cocktail, we'd rather blend that orange and keep the juice with the fiber, and the fiber helps the body metabolize that fructose. So it's not necessarily what you want to be thinking about when you're in a bar, so we want to be doing a little bit of that thinking for you. And if you are trying to drink responsibly, sweeten responsibly, know what you're putting in your body, we want to provide that information and that and those options for you as well.
That's a fascinating idea, and you are the very first mixologist who has suggested that we just use the whole orange so we're getting the fiber and everything.
Yeah.
Give me some other examples of how you go about doing this.
So one of the things that we really try to avoid is agave. And
really? You know, that's so interesting, yeah. Because I think I know a lot of people who are under the impression that using agave is healthier, yeah, and better for you than using granulated sugar,
exactly,
or honey.
Yeah, that's the problem, because it's marketed as a sort of a healthy sugar supplement. And the reality is that agave is up to 90% fructose. So, you know, that's putting so much stress on your liver, particularly when you're combining that with alcohol. So we do avoid agave. We do use sucrose or table sugar. We just use less of it. So we also find that if you add spices or herbs to cocktails such as vanilla or cinnamon, nutmeg, they all increase the perception of sweetness. You don't have to use so much sugar. We also use things like rice malt syrup, which is lower in fructose and is easier to metabolize. We use dextrose, which is 100% glucose. To get a little bit kind of technical, sucrose, which is table sugar, is 50% glucose and 50% fructose. The fructose is the sweet part of that sugar. The glucose is the part, the energy part, and the part that you need in pretty much all of your systems in your body. Your body uses glucose to perform this energy. And so you can actually buy 100% glucose, which we use in our cocktails. It's not as sweet as table sugar, but it is it has zero fructose. So we're just sort of trying to be creative. And as I said earlier, just create more options, more choices. And blended drinks actually are the easiest go-to if you're trying to reduce the fructose load. Because if you're blending pineapples or citrus fruits or whatever, as I say, that fiber is retained to the fructose and it's easier for your body to metabolize and get rid of. If you juice fruit, then you concentrate the fructose, you remove the fiber, and then it's literally just fruit sugar, which is not healthy to you, although it sounds healthy, but it isn't.
If someone is listening at home and wants to approach these changes in sweetening, how do you recommend they go about it?
Well, the simple thing to do is just use less sugar. And, you know, very quickly your palate will readjust. It will quickly recalibrate to a less sweet drink. So that's the easiest thing to do. As bartenders, we often sort of default to, you know, half an ounce of sweetener. And we can scale back over time and your drinks will still be delicious. And the wonderful thing today is that we've got fantastically well-made spirits. So we don't necessarily have to do so much sweetening to cover up what we might have had to in, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago when spirits weren't of the same sort of quality and caliber. So you can dial back the sugar 100%. Consider using other sugar alternatives. We like lucuma, which is a natural sweetener. And we use coconut water as well, which is naturally sweet and lower in fructose. You can use honey. It does contain fructose, but not as much as you find in table sugar. Just be more mindful, I think. That's the main thing. Don't necessarily just default to that half an ounce of sweetener when it's not necessary.
Someone wants to embrace the motto, drink, eat, live.
Yeah.
What do you do?
I think for me, it's about drinking better, eating better, living better. So, you know, it's about making great choices when you do drink. It's about, you know, taking time off from consuming as well. So we recommend, particularly for people in our industry, to have 2 days off in a row of not drinking to give the body time to sort of reset, recalibrate. Eat better, you know, eat a variety of foods, eat real foods, don't eat processed foods, eat the rainbow, you know, try and eat lots of fruit and veg. Support your body, particularly, again, if you're in hospitality, it's a stressful job and has impact on the body, so protect your body through what you eat. And live well, so live better, so move, walk, run, you know, do some exercise, you know, get the body moving again. And that for me is great philosophy for living, you know, sort of better life. It's getting better.
Claire Smith Warner, head of cocktail creation and mixology at Belvedere Vodka. Getting so much better all the time. It's getting better all the time. Better, better, better. It's getting better all the time. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Tune in next week when we celebrate Cinco de Mayo with Milagro Tequila brand ambassador Jaime Salas as he mixes up the perfect margarita. The whole room right now is filled with the scent of lime.
Yeah, I feel as though someone needs to work on a scratch and sniff radio or aroma radio or something along the sorts.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's.
Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.